The most important encounter of Nietzsche's musical life, though, was Wagner, Julian Young.
When he was 17, his friend Gustav Krug introduced him to the piano reduction of Tristan. This is 4 years before the first performance of Tristan, and the two boys played through the entire score and sang all the parts. In 1868, his final year as a graduate student in Leipzig, he did some music criticism for a local paper called the Deutsche Allgemeine. Mostly what impressed him during that time was Meistersinger.
That same year, Nietzsche met his hero, a transformative encounter. Wagner immediately warmed to the 24-year-old writer and composer. At the end of the evening, Nietzsche remembered, Wagner pressed my hand very warmly and invited me most cordially to visit him in order to discuss music and philosophy. And visit he did.
Nietzsche visited the Wagners 23 times at Triebschen. He had his own bedroom. He could just turn up unannounced. He was a member of the family.
In fact, he was so much a member of the Wagner family in that house on the shores of Lake Lucerne in Switzerland that Nietzsche was there for one of the most famous and intimate musical premieres of the whole 19th century.
In the family, it was known as the Stairwell Idyll because it was Wagner's birthday present to Cosima. The players gathered at the foot of the stairwell with Nietzsche in the audience, and the music floated up the stairs to Cosima, who was, as she says in her diary, she says, I awoke, a swelling sound came to my ear, ever louder. I could no longer imagine it a dream. It was music sounding, and what music? As it sounded out, Richard came into the room with the five children and gave me the score of the symphonic birthday greeting. I was in tears, but so was the entire household. The following Christmas, Nietzsche declined the invitation to spend it at Triebschen, ostensibly because he had to work, but really because he'd sent to Triebschen his own Echoes of a New Year's Eve, and he wanted to see what they thought of it.
The more ambitious Nietzsche's music gets, the worse it gets. So the leader, as you pointed out, are actually pleasant enough little tunes going on and perfectly nice. If you listen to it, you would say, I wonder who that's by. It's rather nice. But when he begins to write effectively what he thinks of as a symphonic poem, and then, of course, a sequel to the Siegfried Idyll, I mean, it's the sheer ambition and sort of delusions of grandeur here that then you begin to see this really for what it is. And, of course, Wagner, I think, probably couldn't help laughing. I mean, Wagner could be extremely malicious, as we well know, but I think he just genuinely couldn't help himself laughing. But the fact that Nietzsche was obviously rather offended by this should tell you quite a lot about Nietzsche.
Or maybe we should give Nietzsche a break. He was, after all, writing the philosophical work that would make his name, The Birth of Tragedy.
Nietzsche was supposed to be writing, he was a professor of Greek, so he was supposed to be writing a scholarly monograph. That's what professors do. But what he really wanted to do was to produce a work of propaganda for the Bayreuth project. Wagner needed to raise massive amounts of money to build his own festival theatre in Bayreuth. And Nietzsche really thought of The Birth of Tragedy as his contribution to the Bayreuth project.
Laura Tunbridge.
Well, this is Nietzsche responding to Wagner in the first instance when he first heard Tristan and Meistersinger, and his operas performed well, and also he's caught up with the Wagners, he's visiting them whilst he's living in Basel. So it's a very strong personal response to the man and his music.
So is it Wagner's music then that inspires the ideas behind The Birth of Tragedy? Is it Wagner's music that we have to thank for the Dionysian and the Apollonian in Nietzsche's work?
Probably not exclusively, but they played a large part.
The heart of the argument in The Birth of Tragedy is very simple. 5th century Greece represented the high point of Western civilization. The life of 5th century Greece was the tragic festival. The tragic festival is being reborn in the works by Richard Wagner.
One of the things The Birth of Tragedy lays out is the Apollonian-Dionysian dichotomy. I mean, in a way, it uses Wagner as an exemplar of the possibility of balance between those two elements of human existence in Nietzsche's terms.
Yeah, the Apollonian is basically the words and the Dionysian is the music. The idea is that the music gives tremendous power to the words.
So in this piece, Echoes of New Year, Nietzsche's presumably trying to do what he says music ought to in The Birth of Tragedy. It's only through the spirit of music, he writes, that we can understand the joy involved in the annihilation of the individual. Now, after The Birth of Tragedy, Nietzsche conceived the ideas of the will to power and the Superman in the 1870s and 1880s. Controversial notions, these. Nietzsche wrote, "When I whispered into the ears of some people that they were better off looking for a Cesare Borgia than a Parsifal, they did not believe their ears." So Nietzsche would prefer an ambitious murderer rather than Wagner's holy fool. Another musical piece by Nietzsche from 1872, The Manfred Meditation, based on Byron.
So Manfred is the quintessential early romantic hero. He's solitary, brooding. We find him in the Alps trying to raise the spirits of the people he's encountered, his previous loves and so forth. So in that sense, he fits very much in the vein of the romantic hero such as Goethe's Faust.
What do you reckon to Nietzsche's Manfred Meditation, the piece of music?
God. Sorry.
Laura Tunbridge isn't the only one to be sceptical about this music. Nietzsche sent the piece to Hans von Bülow for approval, conductor, pianist, composer, cuckolded by Wagner.
Von Bülow wrote back that he found the piece the least uplifting and most anti-musical set of marks on manuscript paper I've ever come across. Frequently I had to ask myself, is the whole thing a joke? Perhaps you intended a parody of the so-called music of the future?
There's more. You yourself describe your music as horrible, von Bülow said. It is actually more horrible than you realise.
When he got that devastating judgment from von Bülow, he replied, well, as naughty children say, I won't do it again. Nietzsche only wrote another couple of pieces of music in his entire life.
All right, but there must be something we can get from the Manfred Meditation. Laura Tunbridge again.
It's interesting in the sense that you have him still responding to his previous piece of music, The Echoes of New Year, in the same way that he returns in his writings to similar themes throughout. He's doing that compositionally as well. There's also the sense that he's responding, he claims, to Schumann's version of Manfred, which by this point he's writing off as unsuccessful.
Nietzsche was really very conservative musically. He loved Carmen. He went and saw it four times. Partly because its form was more traditional. He didn't really like continuous melody.
Continuous melody. That was Wagner's domain, the siren song of the music of the future. So was Wagner's music Nietzsche's one true love after all? Ken Hamilton.
Jealous is probably the wrong word. I mean, of course, I can't psychoanalyze Nietzsche. And I think he felt very much in Wagner's shadow. To some extent as a thinker, although Nietzsche was a much more subtle thinker as a philosopher than Wagner, but remember, he's a much younger guy. Wagner is very famous when he meets, and Wagner talks all the time and is just overwhelming and has this immense creative energy, certainly musically, but also in terms of drama and everything like that. And Nietzsche in the mid-1870s obviously begins to feel he needs to get out of Wagner's shadow. But nevertheless, he still is enormously affected by some of Wagner's music, even when he's saying Carmen is much better in the end. He's saying, we must Mediterraneanize music, he keeps saying. But then he also writes a friend saying, you know, the prelude to Parsifal is one of the most wonderful things he's ever heard. But of course, he'd never write that in public, but he could write it in private.
Wagner was, you know, massive.
Julian Young.
Somewhere he says, the trouble with Wagner is he's a huge tree and nothing can grow in his shadow. It all comes to a dramatic finale in 1876 when he walks out in the middle of the first Bayreuth Festival.
Well, you see, that actually, it was one of the big reasons for the break in 1876. I know we all talk about, you know, philosophical differences and stuff, but Wagner actually wrote a letter to Nietzsche's doctor. And Nietzsche, of course, suffered very severe migraines and debilitating illnesses for days. And Wagner wrote a letter to the doctor saying, look here, doctor, you needn't look for a very serious cause for this. The fact is he needs to get married or find himself a girlfriend. He's spending too much time on his own in one-handed activities, which was bad enough. But the fact was that somehow that this got either through the doctor or because Wagner maybe made some indiscreet comment, got out during the Bayreuth Festival.
That in 1870.
During the circle. And so Nietzsche found himself in a very embarrassing position. And if you ask me, Tom, I think, since we're all human beings, there can be philosophical differences, but I think that was one of the real problems that Nietzsche had at that point.
There were differences then, later in Nietzsche's life, but music would remain absolutely essential to his thinking, even if that music wasn't always Wagner's.
To be effective, to be ultimately effective, his philosophy needed to be combined with music.
His response to the music is also partly based on where he needs to be philosophically at any one time. And at the time when Nietzsche himself was an enormous admirer of Wagner's favourite philosopher, Schopenhauer, then obviously the two go in tandem. But then as Nietzsche begins to think of Schopenhauer as too nihilistic, as saying no to life, whereas you need to say, according to his philosophy, yes to life. And that's, of course, what the hymn to life, the Hymnus an das Leben, is about. Say yes to life. This truly awful bit is actually this passage here where he suddenly goes from... and then this dreadful sort of slap on the face of a transition passage, effectively.
But is there the possibility that the whole thing is a Nietzschean existential sort of joke, even to the extent that he sent that piece? We know he sent this piece despite what von Bülow had said to him in 1872. He sent this piece in 1887 to von Bülow. Von Bülow didn't reply and just said, you know, I'm too busy to be able to engage this. I mean, is there the possibility that this is a kind of ironic slight at the whole thing and a sort of two fingers at the whole idea of composition in general?
Well, there's certainly a possibility. There's always a possibility. And we are dealing here with a man whose entire oeuvre is partly based on irony. A guy who, in his autobiography, entitles a chapter, Why I Am So Clever, and the next chapter, Why I Write Such Good Books, which is certainly meant partly seriously and partly ironically.
I don't think we should expect him to be as good in both spheres. And I think that's the problem. There are very few people who are truly polymaths in the sense of being able to excel. One of the reasons that Nietzsche was attracted to Wagner was that he thought he was somebody who could work well in all different fields, and that was something that he would have liked to have been able to do. So his music's interesting in the sense that that's the style in which he wanted to write. He's accomplished enough to do a kind of reasonably well-crafted piece. It doesn't mean that we should necessarily herald him as this great composer to stand alongside the people he admired compositionally.
The real sophistication is in the prose and the comments on other people's music, whether you agree with them or not. I mean, here is somebody who's enormously subtle and has thought about it, but just doesn't do it himself.
Es ist der Regen stark im Ort, die Nacht.
So there we are, Friedrich Nietzsche, great philosopher and enormously mediocre composer. I don't know, though. If it's good enough for Dietrich Fischer-Dieskau, it's got to have something going for it.
Meine Seele tief erklingt. Friedrich Nietzsche's horrible music. This evening's 20 Minutes was presented by Tom Service, and the producer was Hannah Sander. Welcome back to the Royal Albert Hall and to Radio 3, the home of the Proms, with me, Christopher Cook. And remember that you can find out more about the background to tonight's music on the BBC Proms website, as well as for every single BBC Prom, and indeed much else besides. Though if you want to be here with us at the Hall, then there are always large numbers of tickets for the arena and the gallery on sale every day. We've heard already about the sad news of the death of Seamus Heaney, one of the giants of English literature over the past half century. And there is, for many of us here, I think, just talking to people this afternoon, a sense, of course, of Heaney and the Proms. Some of you may know that when he was awarded a few years ago now the David Cohen Prize for Excellence in Literature, he was asked which two poems he'd like to choose that summed up his lifetime. And the one he chose first was a poem called The Underground, a poem that was written when he was in London on his honeymoon. And it begins, "There we were in the vaulted tunnel running, you in your going away coat speeding ahead, and me then like a fleet god gaining upon you before you turned to a reed. Or some new white flower japped with crimson as the coat flapped wild and button after button sprang off and fell in a trail between the underground and the Albert Hall. Honeymooning, mooning around, late for the Proms, our echoes die in that corridor." Seamus Heaney, remembering his honeymoon on his way with his new bride to the Proms. The second half of tonight's Prom begins with Vladimir Yurovsky conducting the London Philharmonic Orchestra in a performance of Sibelius's Pocula's Daughter. We think of Pocula's Daughter as a tone poem with a story drawn from the Kalevala, the Finnish epic poem that so moved the composer. A story about how the hero, Vinju Mirinen, pays court to the daughter of the moon god, Pocula, but to no avail when she asks him to conjure a boat from the spindle of her spinning wheel. Yet Sibelius described this work as a symphonic fantasy, and even considered calling it a hero's life. Except, of course, that Richard Strauss had already bagged that title. But whether it's a tone poem with a story or a one-movement symphony, this is Sibelius at his most musically descriptive. From its dark beginning in the nocturnal kingdom of the moon god to the icy end as the disappointed hero, having failed to win the moon god's daughter, goes alone on his own way through a particularly bleak musical landscape. It's a piece that really not only shows off Sibelius's extraordinary skills at writing for a very large orchestra indeed, laid out now on the platform here, but also an opportunity for the orchestra itself to scintillate and dazzle. A reminder that in that brief period in when he was writing these tone poems and the other works deeply influenced by the Kalevala, Sibelius was writing at full force, writing at the full measure of his talent. And here is Vladimir Yurovsky to conduct the London Philharmonic Orchestra, led tonight by Peter Schurman, in a performance of Sibelius's Pocula's Daughter.
Thank you.
Ice, you feel, has gripped the hero's heart when he fails to win the Moon God's Daughter. The London Philharmonic Orchestra, conducted by their principal conductor, Vladimir Yurovsky, have just played Sibelius's tone poem, Popular's Daughter. Five horns, three trombones, and a tuba at the back of the orchestra. And does anybody really write quite like Sibelius for the brass in an orchestra? A real sense of chill. Richard Strauss's, or rather Friedrich Nietzsche's Zarathustra, is just about everything that Sibelius's hero, Vinu Mirinen, isn't. A man who makes his own moral laws without God, who is, of course, dead. Applause from the promenaders as members of the London Philharmonic Orchestra come back to the stage for the final work in this evening's prom. The man who Strauss writes about, of course, Zarathustra, makes his own moral laws without God, who is, of course, dead. He's the master of his own life and its choices, and an Übermensch who challenges conventional pieties. Strauss was completely smitten when he first read Nietzsche's Also sprach Zarathustra in 1892, while convalescing from an illness caught that year. 3 years on, and he set to work composing a tone poem from what he had read, a work that he described as being freely after Friedrich Nietzsche. To start with, one of the most arresting openings in the entire history of Western music. But is Nietzsche set to music, or just Strauss? Tonight's conductor, Vladimir Yurovsky.
Well, I personally think that Strauss was very much enthused by Nietzsche's writing, and he probably found some echoes of his own worldviews, which were relatively mildly nihilistic. And the other question is, what has come out on the surface, the final artifice, is, in my opinion, very far removed from the complexity and seriousness, and also from this very, very peculiar nihilistic humor of Nietzsche. And I hear this piece as a connecting member between the 19th and the 20th century.
What's the challenge of this piece for this huge orchestra?
It's an incredible display of orchestral power and skills, but I think the main task for the players is to pace themselves through these solos and also to never lose the elegance and the lightness. There's a famous Straussian saying, conduct my electra as though written by Mendelssohn, Fairy's music. I think even more so it applies to Zarathustra. And so I think the biggest task for the orchestra and the conductor is to present it as a very classical, elegant, slick piece of music with the influences of Vienna waltz in it.
Tonight's conductor, Vladimir Yurovsky. Also sprach Zarathustra travels from sunrise to night in 9 linked episodes, each of which takes its cue from Nietzsche's poem. So there's Of the Backworldsman, Of Joys and Passions, The Song of the Grave, The Convalescent, and to end, The Song of the Night Wanderer. And here now is Vladimir Yurovsky to conduct the London Philharmonic Orchestra in a performance of Richard Strauss's tone poem, Also sprach Zarathustra.
Thank you. Thank you.
philosophy, made music, well, perhaps, but absolutely magnificent. Richard Strauss's tone poem, Also sprach Zarathustra, Vedi Mirorovsky conducted the London Philharmonic Orchestra. And at the end, he applauded the whole orchestra, though no one except those sitting in the stalls by the organ will have seen it, by simply tapping his baton on the desk. And then, in a wonderful touch, gave a huge thumbs up to the organist sitting up there in the organ loft. A piece that really shows an orchestra off at best advantage. Mirorovsky returns to the platform. Principal trumpet with the orchestra, given a solo bow. That's Paul Benningston. And of course, tonight's leader, Peter Schoenberg. Strings, the brass, the woodwinds joined in. A fine evening for the whole orchestra, and a wonderful way perhaps for one of them to say goodbye, because tonight is the last performance of the second oboist with the orchestra, who retires, Angela Tennant. But what memories she'll have of her last appearance with this orchestra. 30 years she's played with them. Clearly time to do something else with her life. Almost running back, tonight's conductor, Vladimir Mirorovsky. In the middle of his orchestra, this London Philharmonic, of course, is an orchestra for all seasons and many places. Their usual home is the Festival Hall, where they'll be beginning their autumn season very shortly. Huge applause for the brass, trumpets, cornets, trombones, two tubas, and the timpanist. And I think we're all going to wait. Yes, the principal horn with the orchestra, John Ryan, and the six other horn players. Strauss asked for seven horns for Also sprach Zarathustra, as well as two harps. Well, the orchestra will be returning to the Festival Hall for their winter season. In the summer, they play at Glyndebourne. They've just finished with their performances there with a triumphant Billy Budd. And as well as opera and classical repertoire, they're much sought after to play music for the movies. They were the orchestra who played, recorded all of the music for the Lord of the Rings trilogy. And that, very touchingly, is applause to Angela Tennant, standing applauded by her colleagues, who leaves the orchestra tonight after 30 years. Well, the applause is going to continue for a great deal longer here after Mr. Strauss's Also sprach Zarathustra, I'm sure. But for now, it's time for us to say goodnight from the Royal Albert Hall. So here's Ian Skelly for the rest of the evening on BBC Radio 3.
Christopher, thank you very much indeed. Christopher Cook was at the Royal Albert Hall for us tonight here on Radio 3. Don't forget that you can hear that prom again anytime you'd like to over the next 7 days by going to the Radio 3 website and following the links to the Listen Again options and the iPlayer radio. Or, if you prefer, why not tune in to Radio 3 next Thursday afternoon, this coming Thursday, in fact, when the concert features as our proms repeat that afternoon. Afternoon on 3 is every afternoon here on Radio 3. Well, we're back live at the proms tomorrow afternoon at 3 o'clock for another proms Saturday matinee. The season's focus on Britain and his contemporaries continues tomorrow afternoon with the first performance of Britain's Elegy for Strings, written 6 years before the Simple Symphony, as well as music by Tippett, his Little Music for Strings, and also Walton, his String Sonata. That's all at 3 o'clock tomorrow afternoon. And having heard from John Wilson and his orchestra earlier in the week on Monday, we're going to be back in that particular vein. If you missed it, he performed music of an earlier era in Hollywood on Monday night. It's well worth listening to if you missed it. Still time to hear it on the iPlayer radio. Tomorrow night, though, the music will be composed for various war films. The March from True Glory, Walton's suite from the film The Battle of Britain, Ice Cold in Alex, Dangerous Moonlight. They're also featured. They're all featured in our prom tomorrow night, which is given by the BBC Concert Orchestra, conducted by Keith Lockhart. And in the second half, music Coming a little closer to home, the music of Strauss again, also John Williams, his suite from Star Wars, and among others, David Arnold, who has written more familiar music than perhaps you might realise. Plenty of James Bond themes, for instance. Tomorrow night, though, you can hear some of the music he composed for the blockbuster Independence Day. So buckets of popcorn at the ready. We'll be live at the Proms tomorrow evening at 7:30 here on Radio 3. Well, next tonight, we're going to head off on a gold rush, the rush for poetry in California, which has always been a fertile part of the world for great poetry, right back to those gold rush days and throughout the 50s and 60s with people like the Beat Poets. It's always been a bit of a hotbed for revolutionary ideas, too, as you'll hear in our documentary feature tonight, in which the poet Dana Joyer talks to fellow poets and musicians about their work and what California has done for them. You can hear a wide range of music, too, from John Adams to the songs of Tom Waits. After the Gold Rush, the poetry of California is at 10 o'clock tonight here on Radio 3. And the poetry continues a little while after that, when we'll pay tribute to Seamus Heaney, whose death this week was announced today. That's at 11:15. And then we'll sweep you off into the late night with Lopakatari, who'll be here with all manner of new tracks from around the globe, plus a session from the bluegrass band The Wagon Tales. That's World on 3 tonight at 11 o'clock, here on BBC Radio 3. Well, it's 10:15 now. Music to take us to the first of those programmes by Scarlatti, one of his 555 or so keyboard sonatas he produced during his many years serving the court in Madrid, and in doing so, opening up the possibilities of the keyboard. So many of them are gems, including this one, a sonata in E, a gentle and expressive one. This full of the flavours of courtly and not so courtly Spain. The pianist in this recording is Yuja Wang. Thank you. I could listen to those all day long. That was the Sonata in E, Kirkpatrick, rather, 380 by Scarlatti, played there by Yujo Wang. The time now is just after 10 to 10, and from the arid hot temperatures of Madrid, let's return to Britain to hear an idyll by George Butterworth, composed in 1913, which was precisely the same year that his friend Vaughan Williams composed his London Symphony. Here he weaves together two folk songs which Butterworth had collected in 1907, the first of which gives the piece its name, The Banks of Green Willow.
Thank you.
The Banks of Green Willow by George Butterworth, who died just 3 years after composing that music on the 5th of August 1916 on a return from an assault on the Somme. It was played there by the London Symphony Orchestra and conducted by Richard Hickox. We've been offering extensive coverage of the Edinburgh International Festival every morning for the past fortnight here on Radio 3, and there's a chance to listen again to many of the concerts that we've broadcast. They're available on the Radio 3 website. They sit there whenever you'd like to listen to them for 7 days after their live transmission. Andreas Scholl, for instance, gave a wonderful recital yesterday morning with the pianist Tamar Halperin, songs by Haydn, Schubert and Brahms, and also Mozart. Well worth a listen. bbc.co.uk/radio3 will give you a link to the iPlayer radio. And our coverage continues. Here's Donald MacLeod.
It takes a lot to get the Usher Hall audience on its feet, but the Chamber Orchestra of Europe and the energetic young French-Canadian conductor Yannick Nézet-Séguin raised the roof with their adrenaline-fueled performance of Beethoven's Seventh Symphony. You can hear that, the second of a pair of concerts they gave at this year's Edinburgh International Festival. On Monday, you can hear the Orchestra of Virtuosi at Beethoven's Eroica Symphony, Strauss's Metamorphosen, and Haydn's Joyful Sinfonia Concertante. And on Tuesday, the orchestra delves further into the richly contrasting worlds of Strauss and Beethoven with that Seventh Symphony that got them a standing ovation. The Chamber Orchestra of Europe from Edinburgh on Monday night at 7:30 on BBC Radio 3.
Back to tonight, and in 45 minutes' time, we'll be paying tribute to Seamus Heaney, whose death was announced today in a change to our advertised programme in our essay at 11:15. And we'll continue in that poetic vein now with our featured documentary. The Golden State is famous for fine weather, sadly now for wildfires, as well as for fine wine and fine verse. Perhaps you'll know Allen Ginsberg and also Lawrence Ferlinghetti. Well, now Dana Goya, one of America's leading poets and essayists, goes beyond the beats, considering the past, present and future of Californian poetry in After the Gold Rush.
One of the things that I find in California is an enormous chaos, a soup of all kinds of things, each one of which is potentially likely to break forth into the next great thing. And I think that that's kind of wonderful.
It's often the case that the poet is out there in the mountains, in wilderness, that spaces where there are no roads or buildings that are bigger than, say, the entirety of England. So that gives you the opportunity to get off by yourself and think about human consciousness and the universe in a sort of bare and stripped down relationship. And there are things to say. And so California poetry looks different for that reason.
All the California, California, coming home.
If someone from another planet, let's say England, came here and asked you what made the Bay Area literary scene special, what would you tell them?
There's a special history here. Many of the keenest battles of American poetics have been, this is the battleground for it. This is the heartbeat, if you will, of American poetics.
Our poets in California have been bardic. We don't have any Emily Dickinsons here. I think that our poets have really felt that they've got a public role. They have wanted to be bards.
California, oh, California.
The poem goes, tattoos, poems fill our pages. Tattoos puncture flesh, raíces. Mis raíces las cargo siempre conmigo. Enrolladas me sirven de almohada.
When you arrived in California at 20, after being raised in Mississippi and Michigan, were there any surprises for you in California?
Yes. California appeared to be free. You could go anywhere you wished, and you would be accepted on equal footing with everyone else. I later learned that this was the legacy of Gold Rush days, when nobody really wanted to talk to anyone else about what they'd been doing before they showed up on the scene. And so it was kind of out of social politeness. People would not inquire about your background. You were starting out anew.
I wasn't a poet when I came to San Francisco, and it was here that I discovered poetry. And it was easy to call yourself a poet in the Bay Area. People didn't think you were insane.
7 California writers describe in both English and Spanish the poetic landscape of the Golden State. It is a chaos, a soup, a battleground, a promise of freedom, a vast wilderness challenging human consciousness, a tradition of bards and public utterance, a chance to reinvent yourself. In some curious way, since the gold rush of the late 1840s, poetry has been connected to the so-called California Dream.
I think the California Dream is really a succession of breakthroughs for ordinary people or ordinary people who are tired of being ordinary people and want something else.
But California and the California Dream is also a place of contradictions because no one dream will fit its nearly 40 million inhabitants. To an outsider, California poetry is beat poetry, rebellious, bardic, and free.
I saw the best minds of my generation destroyed by madness, starving, hysterical, naked, dragging themselves through the Negro streets at dawn looking for an angry fix.
But the Beats movement, now half a century in the past, was only one famous manifestation of the spirit of independence, opposition, and individuality that characterizes California poetry. What does California poetry sound like today? Here is one example of its contradictory nature, a Shakespearean sonnet about sex and tattoos by Kim Adonizio.
I like to touch your tattoos in complete darkness when I can't see them. I'm sure of where they are. Know by heart the neat lines of lightning pulsing just above your nipple. Can find, as if by instinct, the blue swirls of water on your shoulder where a serpent twists, facing a dragon. When I pull you to me, taking you until we're spent and quiet on the sheets, I love to kiss the pictures in your skin. They'll last until you're seared to ashes. Whatever persists or turns to pain between us, they will still be there. Such permanence is terrifying. So I touch them in the dark, but touch them, trying.
One of the most striking and I think pleasurable things about your work is you combine two features that one doesn't necessarily expect to see or hear together. The first is a sense of poetic form, meter, rhyme, and the other is a kind of very in-your-face subject matter, sex, drugs, and rock and roll, and this is a wonderful combination, and it's sort of your poetic personality. How did that happen?
It's kind of funny that people don't expect things of poetry that they take as a matter of course in other art forms and literature. Although in poetry, you can go back to Catullus if you want to talk about some really interesting material.
Yeah. One of those dirty Italian boys.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. It's always been there. And in literature, you've got Genet and Bataille and Henry Miller and Celine. You've got a whole tradition in literature. And somehow people don't expect that from poetry. And I've always been surprised by that. And of course, if you look at HBO and Showtime and comedians, everybody's just doing that. And I don't think I set out to do something different. I just set out to write about life as I saw it. If you could
save me. California has been the experimental laboratory of American poetry, where one literary movement has followed another in energetic opposition. The Beats were followed by the language poets, who were in turn rejected by the new formalists. Multiculturalism emerged in the San Francisco Bay Area and quickly splintered back into Latino, Asian, African American, gay, and feminist poetics. Now, when you started writing in the 70s in San Francisco, form was forbidden. I mean, to write in form was to be rebellious against the literary establishment. How did you happen to gravitate towards that sort of formal musicality that your poems have?
I just came to poetry, you know, reading free verse and found some poems I liked and didn't really know what to read. And then I took a class on meter in graduate school. And then really, I just started thinking on iambic pentameter one summer and started writing sonnets. So it was very much sort of a backwards way to come than a way, say, that free verse developed in the 20th century, where everyone was steeped in all of those traditional forms and they were trying to break out of them.
There has never been a single style or approach for California poetry. What there has been is an odd intensity of independence and authority. And among the best poets, something else, something quite distinctive. The overpowering presence of nature, raw and untamable on the western edge of North America. The dramatic Pacific coastline, the vast mountain ranges, the towering redwoods, enormous deserts and gentle valleys, where humanity, constantly arriving in greater numbers, is the interloper.
By the 1860s, after the gold rush, you might have 300,000 people here coming from eastern United States, England, Europe, Sonora, Chile.
The great California historian and former state librarian, Kevin Starr.
You have another population boom in the 1880s when the Atchison, Topeka, Santa Fe Railroad comes into Southern California. Then you have another population boom in Southern California between 1900 and, say, 1925, when the population of Los Angeles alone increases by a million, from 100,000 to about 1.2. So slightly more than a million. And then you have the extraordinary boom of World War II. California is one of the Gibraltars of the Pacific. And then you have the post-war growth of the state from 8 to 9 million at the height during the war to 17 million by the mid-60s to pushing, they say 39 million, but I'm sure we're into 40 now. So if you're looking at those population drifts, you have to say, what brings that many people in so consistently?
California is now, by a huge margin, the most populous state in the U.S. And even as its state government teeters on the edge of bankruptcy, it ironically remains the richest. California is the world center for both high tech and entertainment, and it is America's largest agricultural state. If California were a separate nation, its economy would rank 9th in the world, larger even than India's.
Everybody who came out here was seeking change and willing to take risks with their life.
Beyond all the statistics, California is, and has been since the gold rush, a symbol.
Then they got out here and there was no further west to go and fall into the sea. And so at that point, they had to establish some kind of California culture.
Kim Stanley Robinson is a science fiction novelist whose best-selling Mars trilogy has explored ecological issues.
That is a very future-oriented culture, very utopian culture, thinking we can make a better life here. That was the original impulse why people came here at all. Now, immediately you get ensnared in various kinds of realities. You never really escape the economic engine that we are trapped in. And it's always been filled with a sense of really rapid social and technological change, because everything in California in the last half century has been built and transformed, and the coastal plains have been overlaid by a ridiculously bad infrastructure built for the automobile rather than for human beings. So all of these mixtures of utopia and dystopia are so evident to the eye here that any writer, I speak for myself here, if you're a California writer and you want to be a realist about California, you become a science fiction writer by necessity in order to properly describe the situation here, which is a science fictional situation.
There has always been something prophetic and futuristic about California poetry. From the visionary heights and hellish depths of Allen Ginsberg's Howl to the post-human apocalypse of Robinson Jeffers, who envisioned the pristine landscape of California cleansed of its human invaders. Here is one particularly gentle and startlingly prophetic poem by Richard Brautigan, who was both the last of the beat poets and the first bard of the hippies.
All watched over by machines of loving grace,
Published in 1967, the year of San Francisco's world-famous Summer of Love, Brautigan's poem accurately predicts the advent of cyberspace and virtual reality.
I like to think, and the sooner the better, of a cybernetic meadow where mammals and computers live together in mutually programming harmony like pure water touching clear sky. I like to think, right now, please, of a cybernetic forest filled with pines and electronics where deer stroll peacefully past computers as if they were flowers with spinning blossoms. I like to think, it has to be, of a cybernetic ecology where we are free of our labors and joined back to nature, returned to our mammal brothers and sisters, and all watched over by machines of loving grace.
Not all California dreams end happily. 17 years after the Summer of Love, Brautigan killed himself. Suicide has been the fate of several other celebrated California poets, including Weldon Keyes, who leapt off the Golden Gate Bridge, and Lew Welch, who wandered into the wilderness with a rifle, leaving a note that said, "I had great visions, but could never bring them together with reality. It's all gone."
My family, we are dreamers.
The poet Francisco X. Alarcón.
I had no money. My father was a gambler, and so my mother lost everything. They didn't have any suitcases. They had just a big sheet because they had lost everything. And so we had to start from nothing. And so my family, with that money, we actually took advantage of what is called affirmative action. All my brothers went to college. They went to the best colleges in California. And so now my brother, I have a brother who's a doctor. He has his own clinic. He's a neurologist. I have another brother who went to USC, and he's an engineer. I have a brother who's an architect. I have a sister who's a dentist. I have a brother who's a priest. My mother basically is a dreamer. I think she's a true American dreamer.
And her son Francisco became a noted poet, one who writes bilingually in both Spanish and English. In a state whose capital is named Sacramento, and whose four largest cities are Los Angeles, San Jose, San Francisco, and San Diego, the presence of Spanish is felt everywhere. Spanish was spoken in California long before English arrived during the Gold Rush era, and Spanish is still spoken throughout the state. Los Angeles, in fact, now has more Spanish speakers than Madrid.
I'm very happy, actually, that my first book was bilingual, and it was very well received, and I decided to write both in English and Spanish. I have some poems that are in both English and Spanish. Let me read you one.
Yeah.
This actually a poem I wrote when I spent my first year at Stanford, and I went back home, and my mother looked at me very carefully, and she said to me, "What happened to you?" I said, "Why, Mom?" And she says to me, "Estabas más prieto. You used to be a lot more darker." I used to be much, much darker. Dark as la tierra recién llovida. And dark was all I ever wanted. Dark tropical mountains, that very nice. Dark tender lips. And all sing dark, dream dark, talk only dark. Happiness was to spend whole afternoons tirado como foca bajo el sol. You're already so dark, muy prieto, too indio. Some will lash at my happy darkness, but I could only smile back. I'm now not as dark as I was. Quizás sean los años. Maybe I'm too far north. Not enough sun, not enough time. But anyway, up here, dark is only for the ashes. Stuff lonely nights are made of.
In your life, Francisco, you were an outsider in many ways. In California, you were an outsider because you were Mexican. But you're also an outsider in some ways because you're gay.
That's right.
How has that affected your identity in your writing?
It's crucial for me. I did the first collection of homoerotic poetry ever written by Latinos in the States. I come to the conclusion that being gay is just a gift of the gods. And so that gives you a sense of who you are. Yes, you are an exile. An internal exile. But at the same time, you know, I think you've become at ease with life. I'm not at all bitter.
Except for the Indian tribes, all Californians were originally immigrants. And even in the early days, many of them were writers and artists.
During the Gold Rush, you have an enormous amount of marvelous writing about the Gold Rush. Captain Marryat, for instance, the English writer, Alexander Dumas, who never gets here, writes a Gold Rush novel. Another honest mirabilis in 72, 73, when Mark Twain writes Roughing It and Clarence King writes Mountaineering in the Sierra Nevada. During the Civil War, for a period of time, San Francisco became something of a literary capital for the nation. Robert Louis Stevenson coming here to court a California young lady, Isabel Strong, whom he married, writes Silverado Squatters about their honeymoon in Napa. You have the return also from England of Joaquin Miller, who writes poetry on the Sierra Nevada.
Joaquin Miller was almost a beat poet of the 19th century, wasn't he?
Yes, he was. He had similar values. He lived among the Native Americans in up around Mount Shasta, and had a daughter there whom he named California.
But the real beat movement began half a century later in San Francisco, in the circle of artists and writers around the bohemian poet and intellectual Kenneth Rexroth. The wider world came to celebrate Allen Ginsberg and Jack Kerouac, but the real brains behind the beat movement was the cantankerous and creative Rexroth.
I don't believe that the present school of technical criticism, which flourishes in America, particularly in the academic world, is very effective.
In 1940 is when Kenneth Rexroth publishes his first book, and Rexroth describes coming to California as like dropping into the world of Trollope. No one knew anything about anything.
Poet and critic Jack Foley does a weekly radio show on Berkeley's KPFA, where Rexroth once hosted one of America's first literary talk shows.
They'd ask him, who was California's best writer? He would say Gertrude Stein, and they knew her, but they knew her socially, not as a writer. They didn't know she wrote. And something begins to happen with Rexroth, who begins to explore this place and to teach what he understands to be what the place dictates.
For most poets, what California dictated